strength and growth depends the strength of others.
Development isn't charity. It's one of the smartest investments we can make in our shared future.
Well, poverty is not about not having money. Poverty is about living a life that is not to its full potential.
Welcome to the Future Development Podcast, a conversation series from the Polson Institute for Global Development at Cornell University. Here we engage with ideas and issues across contexts that bear on addressing poverty and inequality in our world.
My name is Stephanie Enlow, and I am a PhD student in the Development Sociology Department here at Cornell University. I'm sitting today with Rachel Besner-Kerr, who is a professor of development sociology and who has been working primarily in Malawi for the past almost 20 years in coordination with a farmer-led organization called Soils, Food, and Healthy Communities, working with farmers to research and implement different agroecology practices to improve food security and nutrition for smallholder farmers. As well as Jahi Chappelle, who is a political agroecologist and senior research fellow at the Center for Agroecology, Water, and Resilience at Coventry University. So welcome to both of you. Thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So today we'll be talking about agroecology, food security, and food sovereignty initiatives that are taking place in various parts of the world, specifically Malawi and Brazil, and the implications that those initiatives have for how to create a more just global food system. So I'd first like to lay out the challenge facing us, rather a large one, and wondering, Jahi, can you briefly outline, as you do in your book, Beginning to End Hunger, how you see the problem of world hunger? What is the problem that we're talking about solving through food sovereignty and agroecology?
Sure. So on the scale of the problem, where people often start, there's around 815 million people today that is estimated lack food security, that they don't have the full nutrition they need for a healthy and active lifestyle. Though importantly, other people point to the fact that that number maybe should be as many as 2 billion if you take poverty levels much more seriously and say that $1 a day is not enough. If you take into account the fact that most poor have to work for a living, because that number of 815 million is based on a sedentary lifestyle. So we have this huge scale problem, and actually even problems measuring it to some extent or disagreements on it. At the same time, when we think about this from the point of view of we say hunger, it seems like we just need more food to feed people. But there's not really that gap to be filled in terms of amount of calories we have in the world. We produce over 5,000 calories every day for every person in the world. And around 2,000 of that goes to waste and conversion to livestock. So we've got this huge outflow of food, and it doesn't make much sense to me to keep pouring more in terms of calories. Instead, what we really need to focus on, which 30 years of research has said this, since the economist Amartya Sen in the 80s at the very least, that hunger or food insecurity is really about a lack of entitlements or a lack of rights, a lack of buying power as well. So we have poverty, and it co-occurs with marginalization, with people not having effective political voice. And really those two things are the cause of hunger, the fact that people aren't able to get society, government, communities to provide them with the tools they need to get access to good food, and that poverty blocks them from getting it the most common way of being able to demand it with your dollar. If you don't have a dollar, you can't demand the food that's there.
Great, thank you. And so I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast that we would be talking about food sovereignty and agroecology as initiatives, movements that can help to address some of these larger structural issues that you're talking about. And so can you quickly for us, Jahi, define what food sovereignty is, how it came about, and how you see it as a potential pathway for ending hunger. And then I'll ask Rachel to chime in with a discussion of agroecology and how it fits into food sovereignty as a framework.
So I'll give a very broad definition. There's, of course, a lot written about this in the scholarship and by social movements, but the idea was developed Partially actually coming out of the Mexican government. The scholar Mark Edelman talks about that being one of the origins of it. But later on, social movements really took up the idea of food sovereignty and expanded it in the 90s, and it's really become a very important idea in discussing hunger right now. And so the basic definition, you know, very basic, would be people's right to define what kind of food system they want. And that can hide how radical that is. It really, to me, speaks about thinking about reinvigorating democracy so that people have a voice and they're able to decide how we should design our food system so that we don't have food that's wasted while people go hungry alongside it. So that includes changing policies, that includes governing markets in different ways, that includes supporting better livelihoods and rights for food producers in particular, who often aren't compensated the cost of what it takes to produce the food. So many of the hungry in the world are people who are food producers. So I often like to say my sort of personal summary, especially in the United States context where food sovereignty is a less common word, is greater rights plus greater responsibilities over the food system. You have the right to say as an individual community what your food system should look like, but then you have the responsibilities to deal with what that means for workers, for the environment, for people in your community.
Thank you.
So to link to what you just described for food sovereignty, agroecology is in a sense the democratization of food production, and I take that from the FAO conference. Brazilian scholar and activist used that phrase, and I thought it was really compelling because it is ecological approaches to growing food, so taking advantage of different biological systems. Things like using organic resources for improving soil fertility and introducing different intercropping systems to reduce pest problems. In doing so, you don't rely on purchasing inputs, and you also learn more about the particular local ecosystem and adapt your food production to reflect that local ecosystem. So it requires a deeper knowledge of your local environment and how to grow food in that local environment. And it requires more control over the inputs to grow that food. So that's a sort of simple explanation for agroecology.
Great. So to ground this discussion in some more specific work or place, as I mentioned, you've been doing work in Brazil and Malawi. And Jahi, your new book, Beginning to End Hunger, presents an in-depth case study of some food security initiatives that have been happening in Brazil and draws on the success of those programs to think through some broader implications for how we can redesign food systems and food policy around the world. So I wonder if you can talk about some of the specific key successes that your book goes through, and then some of the challenges that still remain for those who are working on hunger campaigns in Brazil.
Sure. So I focused my work in this book is focused around the case of Belo Horizonte, a city of 2.5 million people in southeast Brazil. And in 1993, they really started a very aggressive, holistic food security program within the city. And this program went on to become part of the template for Brazil's national zero hunger programs, which have been widely acclaimed and people are trying to replicate them. Within Belo Horizonte, since 1993, they saw a 60% decrease in child hospitalization due to malnutrition, as well as around 70% decreases in infant malnutrition and infant mortality, and actually a 33% decrease in diabetes, which I haven't seen reported before and is an interesting aspect of it, because part of what they were trying to do was especially increase access to fruits and vegetables. That's one of the primary lacks that they saw within the city. And so you have a number of measures that point to Belo Horizonte really dramatically decreasing hunger and addressing food security to an extent maybe not seen before at this scale of a city this big. And then within Brazil, the zero hunger programs took some of the same ideas and some other ones in terms of increasing buying power and access, and also saw pretty dramatic decreases in food poverty around the country. The way Belo Horizonte was able to do that, I point to in my book two main elements of their successes, which they themselves also admit are not enough. It's not a complete success yet. And they say, don't call us a success because hunger still exists. And that attitude is part of it to me. But more substantively, the two things they did was, one, it was a very holistic approach to food security. They looked at supporting local farmers, so availability of food, not just food, but local food, access in terms of having bulletins that listed prices for different foodstuffs around the city to give people the ability to price shop, fixed price produce shops where for equivalent to maybe 50 cents per kilogram, you could mix and match 20 different fruits and vegetables in a variety of stores that worked with the city. And this was still made money for the produce shop owner, but it was a lower margin than a lot of other places. So that increased access. They had very aggressive intervention programs for pregnant and expecting mothers, nursing mothers. Originally fortified flour, which had manioc and eggshells and other things to fortify it. And they've moved to distributing cooking oil and some other basic foodstuffs that seems to be working as effectively now. But the programs really took a multi-dimensional approach. So that's a key part of it and a key focus on poverty and access. The other part is that it really also made more space for democratic participation. Brazil is, within certain circles, kind of renowned for its food policy councils, which they have at a national level, but also going down to the regional and city level. And Belo Horizonte was one of the ones, earliest ones, to adopt a local food policy council when they were revived in 1993. They existed before that in Brazil. But these are councils that are two-thirds local citizens and one-third government representatives. And it gives people a very direct voice into policymaking alongside other experiments in democracy Brazil has had, like participatory budgeting. So without getting into all the nitty-gritty, these spaces where people had more voice, more direct connection with the city government and more accountability to an extent, that I think is the other key part of the story. And it's also a key part where I think they have a lot more work to do to, I think, align with their ideals, but they've gone farther than most other places. And so it's a very exciting innovation that even they would say is not enough.
Great. And so then coming over to Rachel and having an opportunity to learn more about your work, as Jahi mentioned earlier, a huge proportion of the world's hungry are actually smallholder farmers. And that is a place where a lot of your work in Malawi really focuses. So I wonder if you can talk to us about that project and similarly talk about some of the successes you've seen and some of the remaining challenges that you and your partners in Malawi continue to work on.
Sure. So Malawi, for many years, like many or most parts of the world, relied on an industrial approach to agriculture. So fertilizers, hybrid seeds, and monocropping, real focus on maize or corn. And in the 1990s, the supports for subsidies for fertilizer were removed. And so farmers who had relied on this industrial approach to growing food found themselves without alternatives. And that was the time that I started working in Malawi in the late 1990s. And it was a time when there was very high rates of malnutrition in the rural communities. And so I had opportunity to connect with a nurse at the hospital, and we carried out interviews and found that it wasn't just that farmers could no longer afford fertilizer, but there was this confluence of high levels of domestic violence and gender inequality within the home, so that even if there was some food, it wasn't always being shared equally in the household, and sometimes money was being spent on other things that weren't benefiting the household, like alcohol. And there was a lack of knowledge about alternative ways to grow food and a heavy reliance on one crop. So there had been this, you know, big push in Malawi to rely on fertilizer for several decades, and the outcome of that was farmers really didn't know about many alternatives. So we began a very small scale research project that was also a community development initiative out of the hospital, where farmers got to test different organic methods of growing food and very simple things of intercropping legumes and then rotating those with corn. So pigeon pea and groundnut, or pigeon pea and soybean, that could improve soil fertility. But one of the key aspects that we had as part of our work was that farmers could decide what they wanted to test, and then they experimented with these different options and then learned from those experiments. So it wasn't a here's a technology and here's the solution, but here's some ideas. Why don't you try them out in your own context and see what works? And that was a really core part of our approach and something that we've persisted with as the work has continued. But another dimension was we also incorporated early on different community education initiatives to try to get at some of these gender and other social inequalities that were also working to lead to high levels of child malnutrition. And so that's where the Soils, Food, and Healthy Communities, initially a project and now an organization, was born. And we started with only over 100 farming households, but over time began to work with thousands of farming households. And another dimension that became really important was farmer-to-farmer peer learning, so mentoring farmers, one farmer teaching another and sharing their experiences, but then also creating spaces where households and communities could come together to talk about some of the other aspects that were leading to high rates of child malnutrition and food insecurity. So issues around HIV/AIDS, issues around unequal division of labor within households. And so we've used these strategies and expanded our work. And we've been able to show that households who are using both agroecological methods but also participating in these different community education initiatives have had improved food security and improved child nutrition and improved income, as well as evidence that these are having positive sustainable land management implications through improved soil fertility and reduced reliance on a commercial synthetic fertilizer. So we're now working on some other dimensions. One of the things that we're focusing on in the coming years is different ecological approaches to pest management, which is always a challenge when you're using ecological methods. And we're doing a lot of farmer-led research trying to understand better what will work in that context. And we're also working increasingly around issues to do with livelihoods, because it's really challenging in a country like Malawi, where so many people have very low incomes, to even if you're growing more food, than to generate income from that food. So those are some of the areas that we're working on now.
And I just want to jump in and add, actually, as we're talking about agroecology and food sovereignty having these various dimensions, I think Rachel's work has been some of the most exciting in this area, because we often attempt to be holistic and address, sort of like Belo Horizonte, but even beyond that, address multiple issues of social rights, of well-being, of health, of soil health, the environment, and often we don't really achieve getting to all of those. And so I think the work that Rachel and her colleagues have done in Malawi has been very exciting in that manner, as well as the fact that it's really, in my experiences and interactions with Rachel over the years and her colleagues, that really a lot of people from the community have been represented going to talk about the project, co-writing papers, that it hasn't just been stuck in the ivory tower, that there's really been a sharing of credit and responsibility around the project, which I think is trying to live the ideals of food sovereignty rather than just talking about them. So I think that's just also very exciting.
Yeah, I agree. I've also benefited from being able to learn from Rachel and her work and be able to get integrated with some of the work over in Malawi, as well as some of your work, Rachel, here back in the U.S. And you've been very intentional not only about building these strong relationships with our colleagues in Malawi, but also you're intentional about mentoring undergraduates, graduate students, and giving us opportunities to talk about these broader issues around food systems, agroecology, food sovereignty, especially through a graduate collective that you lead up, Food, Agroecology, Justice, and Well-Being, which is a great acronym. I'll let the listeners say that for themselves. And so I wonder if you would talk more about your work here in the U.S. to mentor students and link with the broader Ithaca community and link the Ithaca community with the communities where we work in Malawi.
Sure. Well, I think I want to touch back on Jahi's influence, because I think you're encouraging academics to think about where they live and how they might live out their, ideals around justice and more sustainable lives has touched me in thinking about my work here in the United States. So even though I do this research in Malawi, I've been reflecting over the last decade about ways that I can try to infuse those ideals in my teaching and in my life here. So we began this collective, which is an interdisciplinary group of graduate and postdoc students several years ago with support from the Polson Institute of Global Development, I should add. And it initially was a space where we shared papers, where we did some shared reading around the themes of food, agroecology, justice, and well-being. So we had nutrition students and entomology, crop and soil science, sociologists, you know, a whole host of different people interested in these issues from different dimensions. But after this kind of period of collective reading and sharing some of our ongoing work, we decided to join forces with a local organization, Groundswell, and some local community activists, and we organized a conference last year, which was trying to explore how we can support more sustainable, equitable, resilient food system here in this region. And that was a really exciting opportunity, where we had over 200 people, and we had workshops held by different people from the community and from the region, and we had some keynote speakers. So we're planning to do another one of those in the future, and I think that's a really exciting opportunity to try and have local connectivities around these issues and not just in our research in other places.
Great. So I see we are running to the end of the time that we have. So to close up, I would like to ask a final question of both of you, and just a quick overview of what do you think are some key lessons that we back here in the U.S. can learn from your work in both Malawi and Brazil, or the work that has been happening in Malawi and Brazil? What can we take from the successes that you've seen there?
Sure. I think that one of the lessons that we can take is the importance of being attentive to local knowledge and really respecting people's ability to problem solve and address food insecurity and hunger in their own communities. With a small amount of resources and some support, they can do tremendous things. So I think that's a real take-home message. And I think also, I think both in Malawi and in Brazil, even under very difficult circumstances where it doesn't seem like you can really change what is a really difficult problem of hunger and malnutrition, actually it is possible to change that. So surely we can do something along the lines here where we have deep inequality and we have food insecurity, very persistent food insecurity. I think that it must be possible to address that problem here.
Yeah, I would completely agree, and I would it would be remiss not to mention the current political situation in Brazil, which has taken a sharp turn away from these social welfare policies. They've defunded a lot of them, including Fome Zero, or cut them back. But at the same time, the idea of Fome Zero and Belarzanchi's programs and a lot of other important innovations came out of activism after Brazil's dictatorship ended in 86. And one of the lessons I draw from that is that as a result of agitation and organization during that time of dictatorship, you had researchers, you had labor unions, you had movements of landless, movements of homeless, anti-poverty. You had people really across a lot of sectors coming together and making a very explicit joint agenda. And basically this joint agenda set some of the template for what Brazil has accomplished. And even with the setbacks now, I don't know how long this will last, but I think there's continuing potential for this organization and really participation in changing their democracy. I don't know how long it'll take, but I think the same is true of the United States. And I'd say one of the things that we can learn from Brazil, which under the Constitution had a requirement to consult civil society, and they made these different citizens' councils, is thinking of new ways to empower people, or maybe sometimes old ways, but in terms of having things that are called like citizens' juries, deliberative polling. There's a lot of interesting things where people are, the average citizen is able to get involved in governance. And I think the thing besides that to do is also to make sure that we're making connections within our community you know, where we can start where we live, as Rachel was talking about, but that could be joining an activity in your community around education or homelessness or urban gardening or whatever. And to me, that's the start, but then, you know, the real challenge is to do that and then start linking those battles. And I think we need a lot more people doing that, reaching out between community groups that they have a strong base in. You have to start with a real base of trust, but then linking these struggles to struggle together, rather than each person, each group fighting for its own resources, when so much of these policies really come from the same place of disempowerment and lack of real democratic voice, not just voting, but actually being able to direct input.
Thank you so much for listening. If there's anything that sparked your curiosity from the conversation today, please check the show notes for links and other resources. The Polson Institute Future Development Podcast is planning on releasing more episodes, so please check back soon.